In addition to MCAST, a subscription to emedhome.com includes over 1,000 video lectures from the best EM conferences. All this and so much more, including hundreds of CME credits each year for the low cost of only $99. emedhome.com. Subscribe now.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the March issue of EMED Home's EMCast. This is Amol Mattu at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and once again, welcome back. Hey, before we get started with the EMCast this month, I wanted to put a plug in for a great upcoming free conference, April 1st, 2020. Less than a month from now, and by the way, it's free, and that's not an April Fool's joke. Check out the website, emergencycardiologysymposium.umem.org. It's a free conference. It's going to be right on our campus, and it is an emergency cardiology symposium, our fifth annual symposium, and the focus is going to entirely be on tough dysrhythmias. So check it out. If you can't make it to join us here on campus, go to that very same website and register for the free live stream. Once again, emergencycardiologysymposium.umem.org. Please do register so we can track how many people are watching. And hey, did I say it's free? Yep, one more time. It is a free conference for anyone who attends or anybody who simply wants to watch the live stream, but you've got to register. All right, folks. Well, let's move on to the EMCast this month. We've once again got three great topics to cover. We're going to kick things off with acute compartment syndrome. It is a musculoskeletal disaster that we haven't talked about in quite some time. One of my colleagues who does a lot of medical legal consulting work on musculoskeletal issues and orthopedic issues, including acute compartment syndrome, Dr. Michael Bond, is going to be reviewing a very nice review article on this topic and providing some of his own insights. Then we're going to change gears and we're going to talk about a very interesting case discussion regarding an entity that I don't think I had ever heard of before. And I'm not going to give you the diagnosis just yet. You're going to have to try to figure it out. But anyway, it has to do with a post-bariatric surgery complication. And then we'll go into a brief review of post-bariatric surgery complications in general. And then we're going to wrap things up with a discussion of a very nice review article published in Western Journal of Emergency Medicine on oncologic emergencies. So with that, let's go ahead and jump right in. All right, well, kicking things off this month on EMCast, we're going to talk about compartment syndrome. It's a nice article published in Journal of Emergency Medicine in late 2019 about this topic, and we probably spend a lot, maybe too much time, I don't know, it was too much time, but on critical care type of stuff and emergency cardiology. But musculoskeletal stuff is really the bread and butter of emergency medicine in many EDs. And we still have to worry about the dangers in musculoskeletal emergency medicine. And one of them is definitely compartment syndrome. Joining me is one of my colleagues, Dr. Michael Bond. He's our residency director and has a particular niche in musculoskeletal emergencies. So, Michael, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
You've actually been involved in med mal cases pertaining to compartment syndrome. So you have a perspective not just on the textbook information, but the clinical pearls, pitfalls, disasters as well. So it'll be great to hear some of your perspectives on this. But why don't we jump into the article here? First of all, can you talk to us a little bit about what compartment syndrome is and why it's a problem?
Sure. Acute compartment syndrome, or ACS, the other ACS. I know we normally talk about acute coronary syndrome, but acute compartment syndrome is definitely a surgical emergency, and it's caused by excessive pressure in the fascial compartment resulting in decreased perfusion within the compartment. And unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation or miseducation about compartment syndrome that we'll get into. But eventually, compartment syndrome leads to muscle and nerve damage and death, resulting in permanent disability. Initially, the pressure initially just impedes lymphatic flow, which unfortunately causes more swelling, and then there a vicious cycle sets up. As the swelling gets worse, there becomes more pressure, which makes the swelling worse, and then eventually after lymphatic flow, capillary and venous flow get compromised. A lot of our teaching, though, says that eventually one of the signs is pulselessness. That's actually extremely rare. If you actually don't feel a pulse, then you really need to suspect an arterial injury and there's something else going on. But if you're getting to that late of a stage that you really think compartment syndrome's resulting in pulselessness, then there's probably nothing you're going to be able to salvage at that point.
Horses out of the barn, as they say.
Way out of the barn. Just document well that it wasn't there when you found it.
put someone else's name on that chart, I guess.
One of the things that's really important about compartment syndrome is timeliness to treatment. So they say neurological injuries are reversible if a fasciotomy or the pressures are reduced within 4 hours, and they're generally irreversible after about 12 hours. And the same for muscle damage. Typically, you can get the muscles to come back after 6 hours, but after 6 hours, there's probably going to be irreversible muscle death, and they'll probably have some weakness, though they might be able to get some of that back. So the incidence is actually upticking a little bit. They say there's about 7.3 cases at the top end per 100,000. And I think this is definitely a significant area for medical legal risk for us. Just to give you an idea, when if we just get sued on a general case, there's about a 20% payout to the plaintiffs. So doctors have about an 80% chance of winning a case if you get named in a suit. For acute compartment syndrome, the payout is greater than 50%.
Wow.
As high as 60% in some studies. Mm-hmm. So the plaintiff's attorneys love compartment syndrome cases. And the claims are normally due to misdiagnosis. We miss it. Or there's a delay in definitive treatment. We have trouble getting the surgeons in, trouble making the diagnosis. And the mean payouts now are over $500,000. So this article reports the mean payout was $574,680. But I've seen cases up into the millions of dollars now. Because one of the problems with this is that it's more common in the young. So there are young that have productive careers ahead of them, so they wind up getting a lot more money because of how it affects their ability to work in the
sure.
future.
I just expect also with all the young high school age athletes out there, that's a big payout if you miss something like that.
Absolutely.
So a lot more to lose there.
And we've talked about knee dislocations in the past, but what's one of the things that comes after knee dislocations is compartment syndrome. And then sometimes if there's no arterial injury, they get sent home too quickly, but they develop compartment syndrome. So compartment syndrome is in the young is more likely to happen because they have stronger fascial structures, increased muscle mass, and they also have a greater incidence of a high energy injuries as opposed to the elderly where everything's a little bit looser, so they have more room for expansion. We do think about compartment syndrome typically within the first 24 to 48 hours after an injury, but it can definitely occur days later, especially if there's a cast or restricting dressing put on the limb.
Mm-hmm.
But don't think of it just because it's a week out that it can't be compartment syndrome. It definitely can develop later on. The most common cause that we talk about is tibial fractures. Acute compartment syndrome with the anterior compartment of the leg is probably the most common. The most commonly missed, though, is probably going to be the deep posterior compartment of the tibia, because you can't really palpate that at all. And it's hard to diagnose unless you're going to do pressures. And the second most common will be the forearm and the volar compartment. And we tend to see that more commonly now with contrast extravasations or forearm fractures. Just one quick reminder, too. Some people will think that an open fracture kind of protects you against compartment syndrome. And there's really no truth to that at all. You still have a significant risk because the hole in the fascia layer is so small and it might not be in the other compartments. So just because there is an open fracture doesn't mean that they can't develop compartment syndrome in other compartments in that same limb. So that's kind of the big general overview of compartment syndrome and where I think there's a lot of medical legal risks associated
sure,
with it.
Sure, sure. Great. Well, let's start with the basic approach to these patients. What are the typical history and physical exam findings that should tip us off to this diagnosis?
We've all been taught like the 6 P's or the 5 P's of compartment syndrome, where we're supposed to look for pulselessness, pallor, pain, paresthesias, and paralysis. Well, as I already mentioned, pulselessness, very rarely, if ever seen, and the same with pallor. If you have those, then you really need to be considering vascular injury and going down a different pathway. Now, they might develop compartment syndrome along with a vascular injury, but you need to definitely be looking at arterial Dopplers or looking at getting a CTA to make sure there's no arterial injury involved. But the most common thing that we'll see is the patient's going to complain of extremity pain. They normally describe it as severe burning and a very deep pain. And the key for us on physical exam is that it gets worse with passive stretching in the compartment. So if they have an anterior compartment of the leg, when you dorsiflex and plantar flex the foot, they'll have increased pain, and that should hint that maybe they have compartment syndrome.
Sure.
One caveat, though, is in late stages, the pain actually goes away because they have nerve damage. And the nerve...
Oh, that's interesting.
So there's some neuropraxia.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. That makes sense.
Yeah, so if they had severe pain and then it gets better, it doesn't mean that they're not in compartment syndrome. It just might be going into a later stage. And so, if anything, it should kick us into that we have to act a little bit more quickly. And then paresthesia is definitely set up. They might complain of numbness and tingling in the distal parts of their limb. And then, of course, motor weakness can definitely occur as the nerves and muscles start to die.
Sure. What's the earliest of those Ps? Is it paresthesia or is it just pain?
Typically, pain is the earliest. And pain has the best sensitivity for it. I know a lot of us have also been told that we should palpate the compartments. And I will... put that on my physical exam just so that I could denote that I was thinking about compartment syndrome. But people just need to realize that it's not very sensitive nor specific. The article actually points out that for the lower leg, it's 24% sensitive and only 55% specific if you think that the compartment's firm. So definitely I wouldn't put a lot of weight into it. It's probably a good thing to document so people know that you were thinking about compartment syndrome.
Sure.
But otherwise, it's really not reliable. And then when we're doing our exam, we should really do serial exams to make sure that things aren't changing, just like we would if we were worried about neck fash. And then the three things that kind of really increase your sensitivity for compartment syndrome, pain with passive stretch, when they have paresthesias, and then pain just at rest. That's 93% sensitive for diagnosis. And if you add a little bit of paralysis or weakness, then the sensitivity is up to 98%.
So three key things there, pain with passive stretch, pain with rest, and paresthesias. Because I was just about to ask you, pain is so non-specific, right? Everybody comes in with pain for something. And if palpating the compartments is not all that reliable, what can we rely on? Those are the three things that you would tell people to really heighten your suspicion based
Correct.
On.
And that's also what the plaintiff's attorneys love. They go to their own educational conferences too, and they teach each other that if there's three or more P's, so of the five P's that we talked about, if there's three or more of those, you should really be thinking a lot about compartment syndrome and doing some diagnostic studies to try to rule that out.
Sure. Right. And then from the physical exam standpoint, pulses, that's going to be really, really late. Pallor is going to be really late, as you said. So there's not a lot on physical exam except maybe just the passive stretch type of stuff.
Correct. Passive stretch, the right context, so patient with a fracture, a burn, other risk factors that would put them at risk for it should make you suspect it. And then sometimes you really do have to go to measuring pressures
sure.
if you're really concerned.
Okay. Well, that takes us to the next step then. Once you start suspecting the diagnosis based on these things, especially those three factors, what testing should you get started with?
So labs are entirely unhelpful. If you get a CK, you might see some signs of rhabdomyolysis, but that could be just rhabdo and with no compartment syndrome. Mm. So there's really no lab test that can help you make the diagnosis. Just like x-rays or CT scans not going to help you make the diagnosis. What we need to absolutely do is measure pressures if you're really worried about it or at least get a consult. The problem with our consultants is sometimes they are naysayers and they don't want to believe that there could actually be compartment syndrome, so they try to talk us out of it. So I find that if you can actually measure a compartment pressure, even though there's studies showing that we might not do it entirely reliably, mm-hmm. And that there's differences when different providers do it, but I think a number is more likely to get them to act than just telling them a story sometimes. It kind of has to force them to come in and actually see the patient. Because when you talk to the surgeons, they'll say, well, I don't really ever measure pressures. If I think they have compartment syndrome, I take them to the OR and open them up and look at the muscle. But unfortunately, we can't do that. So we need their expertise for that part of it. So I think the pressure kind of helps them force them to do it.
Sure. What type of numbers are we talking about?
So the article does a pretty good job of going through this. There's really no absolute number anymore. Mm-hmm. So we're taught that a normal pressure in a compartment is about 10 to 15, a little bit higher in the hand. But what we're really looking at is the delta pressure. And by that, I mean the number they use now is you take the diastolic blood pressure and subtract the compartment pressure from that. As long as that number is greater than 30, they likely don't have compartment syndrome and they can be watched for a while, maybe check the pressure a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But if that pressure is, if that number is less than 30, then you should really think compartment syndrome and they should benefit from a fasciotomy. And if it's less than 20, they absolutely should probably get a fasciotomy. So to give an example, if somebody has a diastolic blood pressure of 80 and their compartment pressure is 40, 80 minus 40 is a final pressure of 40. That's not compartment syndrome. It's a pretty high pressure, but they could probably be watched for a while and observed. But if now if their diastolic blood pressure went down to 60 and their compartment pressure was 40, that's 20, and they probably need a fasciotomy because you're having compromised flow to that limb.
Sure. All right, so testing really does boil down to just doing the compartmental pressure. Obviously, it's a little bit difficult to go through how to do compartment pressures on an audio podcast, but any pearls that you can provide for the listeners?
This might be more for the males out there because we notoriously don't read the directions. But since we very rarely use a Stryker kit, I would recommend people read the directions so they're doing it right. Mm-hmm. But if you have a Stryker monitor, that's the easiest way to do it. The article goes through other methods that you can do, setting up a manometer and looking at the mercury column, or using an art line setup to try to measure the pressures. I think it's a little bit more complicated than the Stryker.
Sure.
But with the Stryker kit, it's really easy. The big pearls are to make sure that you zero the needle at the same angle that you're going to go into the compartment at, because otherwise, if you change the angle, you can throw off the pressures a little bit, and that might take you in or out of the compartment syndrome pressure range. And then when you put it into a compartment, you're supposed to only measure one compartment at a time. So for like the lower leg, it's not uncommon for people to first measure the superficial posterior compartment of the leg and then try to advance the needle directly into the deep posterior compartment. You're really supposed to do a second stick in order to go into the deep posterior compartment to make sure that you're getting a truly accurate pressure. And then you just, with the Stryker kit, you just instill a very little bit of fluid to kind of clean out the needle, which is 0.1 mLs, and then just see what the pressure reading is.
Sure.
A lot of people will do a little wheel to numb the skin up, but you shouldn't be infiltrating a lot of lidocaine into the compartment because you're just going to increase pressures that way. And then the other pearl is to make sure you measure it within 5 centimeters of any fracture to have the most accurate, but to make sure that you're not actually putting the needle into the actual fracture itself, because that'll be much higher than isn't truly in the compartments.
All right, so not into the fracture, but relatively close to the fracture.
Correct.
5 centimeters. And so it sounds like if you have a Stryker kit, key thing is read the directions. If you don't have a Stryker kit, then there's various setups with the manometer that probably, I'm sure there's plenty of YouTubes out there that can show you how to do it, or Robertson Hedges or some other textbook out there.
There's also another company that makes pressure monitors called Compass. I don't have any affiliation with the company, but they are disposable, single use. You can actually use them for LPs if you want to measure pressure that way too. And then you can use any syringe or needle that you have. They're nice in that you can have them just sitting and sterile like you do with your suture kits, mm-hmm. and just have one readily available, where sometimes the Stryker kits are hard for people to find. And they're relatively cheap. Last time I looked at the price, they were about $50 a piece.
Sure. That's not bad.
Not at all.
Compared to, well, I mean, when you get right down to it, compared to the cost of missing a compartment syndrome is
absolutely
incredible. Yeah, I hadn't heard about this disposable, the Compass kit or whatever that may be. Stryker seems to be much more common, but I don't even know if we have Strykers here. When I was at the community hospital, we had a Stryker kit there, and nobody knew how to use it unless you read the directions, so you really do have to read them.
Our Stryker here is kept with Ortho in the OR, and they'll go grab it every once in a while.
Sure.
But again, when you get a consultant involved, that they're really concerned, they normally just will take it to the OR.
Sure. Now, you mentioned a little bit about malpractice earlier. Can you share with us what are the typical causes of malpractice that you see, or maybe some – what are the typical pitfalls that you end up seeing in cases that end up going for malpractice?
As the article said, is failing to make the diagnosis or delays in treatment and documenting those delays. So some cases that have come up are for people coming in complaining of leg pain or arm pain and the splint or cast not being removed. So that's a huge pitfall. If anybody's complaining of pain under a cast, it really does need to be removed so that you can make sure that there's no skin breakdown and to see if that alleviates their symptoms. Removing or bivalving a cast can reduce pressures by up to 85%. So you can take somebody that is in compartment syndrome and completely make it go away just by removing the cast. And if they don't have compartment syndrome or you're not concerned after removing it, you can just put the two HAZ back together and ACE wrap it and have them follow up with the orthopedic surgeon the next day for a new cast.
Sure.
I think some of our hesitancy is people are afraid that they'd have to put a new cast on, but you can just send them back out with a splint if you need to, or ACE wrap the cast together and they follow up with their surgeon the next day. But so that's a huge pitfall, is not actually doing a full exam and looking at the compartments and feeling them and removing the cast to see if that. The other one is delays in care. And I think that comes up more in the community setting. I think a lot of EM docs know what their orthopedic or general surgeons are comfortable taking because they make those phone calls often. And then so they get gun shy, and instead of calling their local doc, they'll call the tertiary care center to try to transfer the patient out. But I would really encourage everybody to call their own orthopedist, even though their ORs might not be available, because the plaintiff's attorneys will say that things could have been done a lot quicker at the community hospital, and the delays in getting the patient transported and then reevaluated at a tertiary care hospital put them outside the treatment window.
Right.
So you want to make sure that you're really documenting things well, that you, if you did call for a transplant, what time it was, if there was any delays in transport, that you made additional phone calls to try to expedite things. But you really want to document well that you put every effort you could into getting them to the definitive care.
Sure.
Other things that we can do is often people want to elevate these people's legs. The idea is to get the edema down, but that actually can hinder arterial flow. So for compartment syndromes, the one time where we just keep the legs neutral at the level of the heart, not above the heart, but just neutral at the level of the heart, so that way arterial flow is not compromised. And that will help with the symptoms. And then just make sure that all bandages, casts, anything that could be constrictive around the limb is removed and looked at, because again, you can decrease pressure up to 85% just by doing that alone. And that's all it might take in some cases.
Sure. All right. So those are some really, really great recommendations. It's disappointing, just in terms of looking over the notes that I've been taking, it's disappointing that palpation of the compartments doesn't seem to get you off the hook, because that's something that I've largely relied on, and I've certainly documented that also. But these three pearls, or at least the three findings, are certainly things that I'm going to be starting to focus a little bit more on. Once again, pain with passive stretch, pain at rest, and also paresthesias. I guess the paresthesias in particular, because pain with stretching and pain at rest is not uncommon in acute injuries, but usually you don't get those paresthesias. And so certainly going to be focusing more on that. But yeah, any final pearls or pitfalls for the listeners, Michael?
So final pearls would be, please get comfortable removing dressings and casts. Ideally, we all have cast saws that we can bivalve a cast, cut it down both sides, make it into two halves, take a look under the splint and cast to make sure there's nothing going on, that they don't have any skin breakdown, infections that could be causing their pain too. And then again, you can just ACE wrap it. The other thing I'd really encourage people to do is break out their striker presser gauge, read the directions, just get re-familiar with it. It's really not that complicated. We do a lot more complicated stuff these days. Ultrasound's a lot more complicated. That this isn't outside our wheelhouse, and we should get more comfortable with it. But just reading the directions, and then if you're not sure where the compartments are, that's where Google can help you.
Mm-hmm.
Just Google an anatomy picture, and you can see where the compartments are. And I think EM docs are really good about reading stuff and figuring it out on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
But pressure measurements, I think, can really help push our consultants to come in and evaluate and treat. If you're telling them that you have a compartment pressure of 40 or 50, it really does put the onus on them to have to come in and see the patient, or at least get them on the phone to say that they're not going to come in, and then you have the rights to transfer them to someplace else.
Right.
But I definitely would encourage the community docs to still get their local community doc orthopedic surgeons or surgeons involved in these cases, and don't just take them off the hook because we never called them. If at anything, if you're unsure, please do serial exams. And this might be most important in our obtunded patients, our alcoholics that may have been laying on their arms or in a weird position, because they can't tell you about the pain. But if you're doing serial exams and they start complaining of something, you'll definitely catch it a lot sooner. And that's a big area that the plaintiff's lawyers like to, whenever there's a hindrance in us actually doing a good exam, like they're obtunded, those definitely cause delays in diagnosis. Not that it's really a fault of ours or limited, but just document well.
Yeah, how easy is that when you've got somebody coming in with an overdose of something and they were found down? We're focusing on rhabdo when we're checking the CAT scan of the head and everything else, but really, we're not really checking the compartments or the extremities or even pulses oftentimes. You maybe a quick pulse check, but it's not something that we really think of it. But as you were saying that, I was remembering we actually had a case of an intoxicated patient who was found down who ended up having bilateral compartment syndrome several years ago. And I think the residents wrote that up and published that case.
Yeah, they're definitely at risk for it. My suggestion there would be just when we do our secondary survey, just make sure when you're going down the legs, just feel the compartments. And the more you feel them, the better I think our sensitivity would get, because you get used to what old people's compartments feel like versus younger people. Of course, you have to take into their body habitus. If like they're a bodybuilder, they're going to be firmer. But you'll get a better sense for it. And if there's any concern, then just consider doing the pressure monitoring. I don't want everybody that's obtunded to get pressure monitoring,
right,
but at least it'll make you go back and do another exam as they get a little bit more awake, and you'll probably make the diagnosis a lot quicker than the 12 hours later when they're ready to leave.
Yeah, and document your diligence. All right. Thanks, Michael. These are some really, really great pearls to help with patient care and also keep you out of trouble, keep me out of trouble for sure. And I look forward to getting you back to talk about some more good musculoskeletal stuff in the near future.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
All right. Well, next up on EMED Home's EMCast, we have an interesting case to discuss. And to be honest with you, I don't even know what this case is, so I'm looking forward to hearing about it. Joining me, we've got two fantastic folks. First, Dr. Sarah Manning. Sarah, welcome back to the EMCast. It's been a while since you were on EMCast, and Sarah took a little time off to expand her family.
Sure did.
And so, well, welcome back.
Thank you.
Joining us also is EMCast newcomer, Dr. Lucas Saklacha. Lucas is an amazingly, amazingly smart, and he'll be humble about this, but incredibly gifted senior resident in our emergency medicine residency who is going to be going on to do a critical care fellowship next year. And as I just learned, you just recently found out about that. Where?
Yeah, so I'll be doing it here at the Adams-Kelly Shock Trauma Center.
All right.
Surgical critical care.
All right, so we're going to be seeing you around and looking for you to open some beds for us.
Yes.
Much appreciated.
So anyway, thanks for joining us, Lucas. So Lucas, this was a case that you saw, is that right?
That's right. Me and Dr. Manning. And
okay.
It's great to be on the podcast for the first time.
All right. Great. Well, hopefully this won't be the last. So anyway, what I'm going to do is I'm going to play Peanut Gallery, and I'm just going to throw things over to you guys. And Lucas, you can present the case, and then we will talk about some interesting points as we go. All right?
Yeah, so this is a case that Dr. Manning and I had several months ago, and there's a couple of good teaching points and some reminders about what to think about in some patients who've had some complex surgical operations. So the patient is a 60-year-old male, has a history of severe ischemic cardiomyopathy with an EF of about 10%, alcoholism, had recently had an AICD replaced, and came to the emergency department after recently being discharged and binge drinking, developed abdominal pain, had vomiting, and was noted on his labs to have a significant elevation in his lipase and his LFTs. And we had assumed care of the patient with care in process, with ultimately the plan for an admission to the surgical service for management of pancreatitis. But as we were managing the patient, unfortunately, they didn't behave the way we might expect a person to behave.
And then things went bad.
Yeah.
And it gets worse.
Uh-oh. Okay, so ischemic cardiomyopathy, a really rotten EF for which he's got an AICD, which was recently replaced.
Yes.
How recently was that?
Days ago.
So
he had been discharged from the hospital, resumed drinking, and then came to us with symptoms that initially really looked clinically like pancreatitis alcoholic gastritis.
All right. And then what happened?
He continued to become more tachycardic, complained of worsening abdominal pain, had failed several rounds of antiemetics. By that time, he had started to physiologically deteriorate, and we got labs that showed an increased lactate. His abdomen was getting more rigid. He was awaiting a right upper quadrant ultrasound to look if there were gallstones or some other cause of the elevation in his pancreatic enzymes. And we got some additional history from him that he had neglected to tell the previous team taking care of him. that he had had some sort of weight loss or gastric bypass type of surgery. And we later did some chart digging and found out that he had had a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, probably for a perforated ulcer in the past. And at that time, we were figuring out what was his fluid status and checking with the ultrasound. And we noticed huge dilated loops of bowel within his belly, specifically in his left upper quadrant. And that was sort of the moment where we had sort of looked at each other and thought, you know, this is an afferent loop syndrome.
Before we get there, and I'm already thinking, what the heck is that? But before I get there, over what period of time did all this happen? Because it sounds like he was signed out to you.
Yeah.
Okay. And was it already signed out as, you know, nothing to do, just waiting to go upstairs, or was the workup still in progress?
So there was a workup in progress.
Okay,
so the right upper quadrant ultrasound was pending, and ultimately our acute care surgeons were planning on admitting the patient to the hospital, likely to their service, pending the results of those studies.
Got it. Okay. So when you came in to assume care of this patient, had he already started decompensating yet, or he was just kind of chugging along?
At this point, he still looked, it was sort of walking and talking like an acute pancreatitis.
Okay. All right.
He had all the symptoms. He had a good story. He was a little complex because of his you know, really, really terrible ejection fraction. You were not giving him as much fluid as I would give a typical pancreatitis patient. And I think that was probably why the general surgery service didn't just swoop him,
whisk him
say,
up.
He's ours. But probably within, I would say, the next couple of hours is when he really started to look worse and worse and worse.
Okay, so increasing tachycardia.
Yeah.
Also,
also pretty tachypneic, too.
Okay.
He was becoming, as we noticed on his labs, he was becoming fairly acidotic, and so he was very tachycardic and very tachypneic as well.
So not just plain old alcohol withdrawal, for example.
No. There was an acidosis to kind of go with it.
Okay. So increasing tachycardia, tachypnea, and you guys got some labs, rising lactate, and he's got increasing abdominal distension.
Yes.
And you did the bedside ultrasound because of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And you see big dilated loops of bowel in the upper abdomen. And then afferent loop syndrome.
Yeah, so we made a little bit of a leap. So this was cool. So
a classic afferent loop syndrome.
Yeah. So alarm bells were going off for a lot of reasons, his vital signs, his symptoms. But then as we dug through his chart and we found that Roux-en-Y history, things start to become really concerning. So whenever I have a patient who's undergone a bariatric procedure, weight loss procedure, Roux-en-Y, I worry a lot, particularly if they're tachycardic, and particularly if their chief complaint is sort of abdominal pain related, because they can have some very sort of interesting and surgical specific complications that can go south really quickly. And at that point, that's when we're doing our ultrasound. We see these loops of bowel. This is one that pops into our head pretty quickly. And this afferent loop syndrome.
Okay. Well, I got to tell you, it popped into my head. So,
So
I'm glad you guys were taking care of this patient and not me. So what exactly, let me just hand it back to you and continue. Tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Yeah. So we had updated the surgical services and obtained CT scan of the patient, which we expedited in the emergency department. And ultimately the CT scan showed what had been suspected both by us and by the acute care surgeons, that this patient had had an obstruction of a type that we'll talk about, and ultimately distension and probably sepsis from that distension of bowel loop that unfortunately had probably already begun to start dying. And he, because of his comorbidities, was not a great operative candidate, and they had attempted surgery, were removing multiple portions of necrotic bowel. And he unfortunately had a very stormy course in the surgical ICU and ultimately passed away after being transitioned to comfort care because it was clear he was not going to recover from this.
So I think the things that made this case an interesting case for us, I think, is that it's a great example of a kind of complication that can happen after bariatric surgery that is not typically seen and doesn't necessarily behave the way that a typical bowel obstruction would behave. And as obesity has become more common, so too have these weight loss procedures. more than 200,000 of these procedures are done every year, so they're going to be showing up on our doorsteps with their associated complications. The most common now, that the Roux-en-Y is sort of falling down a little bit. Things like a sleeve gastrectomy, which is even safer than the already safe Roux-en-Y, and the lap band procedures are getting to be more common. This patient in particular had a Roux-en-Y, and it's very this patient's Roux-en-Y is important to think about because it gives you the reason why he had his complication. So if you'd like, I can review a little bit of the anatomy because it is
definitely
important.
Please.
Yeah. So a Roux-en-Y, what happens is usually laparoscopically now, like more like 95% of the cases are laparoscopic. What happens is the jejunum is divided distal to the ligament of trite. So usually about 30 or 50 centimeters. They cut it in half. They take the roux end, which is the distal end, and they bring it up to the stomach. Now the stomach also gets divided to make a small little proximal gastric pouch. Mm-hmm. And the roux limb and the gastric pouch are connected. And that becomes sort of the transit in which, you know, food is gonna go down. But then you're left with this gastric remnant and this, what we call the biliopancreatic or afferent limb. And so what that proximal jejunum end is taken down about 100, 150, depending on sort of the degree of weight loss desired and things like that.
Sure.
And it's connected to the distal jejunum. And so you have a jejunostomy and a jejunogastrostomy up there. And so that's what creates that Y shape. And so this biliopancreatic afferent limb is the one that caused the problem in our patient. And so think about this. It's a blind loop, right? It's got a blind gastric pouch and then this biliary drain. And so that's where our problem arose with our patient.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk, Lucas, about, sort of clear the mud, what is afferent loop syndrome?
So essentially, when we talk about the Roux-en-Y procedure, you have two branches to the Y at top. You have one that connects to the stomach and one that is now this blind-ended pouch. And we kept coming up with ways to try to conceptualize this, to think about some of the problems that you encounter. And one way I thought of was to think of this as a giant appendix. It's a giant loop of bowel. It's not connected to anything in continuity, and all the drainage from the common bile duct, so your pancreatic enzymes, all your bile salts, mix at the Y, but that connection can become tight for a couple of reasons. It can be obstructed. You can get certain types of hernias that these patients are predisposed to, mm-hmm. and if that end can't drain, it's going to continue to fill with fluid. And that fluid causes distension, and ultimately the same way an obstructed appendix can distend and necrose and potentially rupture. The afferent loop, the excluded part of this new gastric tract that's been created surgically, can be blocked off. And as it expands, it creates not just pain, but tachycardia, nausea, vomiting, mm-hmm. Bacterial overgrowth, and then ultimately necrosis or rupture of that bowel that has no place to drain but continues to get secretions and continues to get pancreatic enzymes and bile salts.
Right. Wow. Can it just, when they do the surgical procedure, can they just remove it so it doesn't become an issue?
Not so much, because you got to have an outflow tract for the bile that and pancreatic enzymes that you're going to make. And eventually you do need those to aid in digestion. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a necessary evil.
Unlike the appendix, which is just
you can get rid of that guy. Yeah.
Wow.
In this case, there's a lot of important stuff in that tract that needs to be preserved.
So is that loop what actually ended up necrosing and becoming infarcted? Or what exactly did they find in the OR?
Yeah. So in his his first trip to the OR, they found constrictive adhesive bands around his biliopancreatic limb. Mm-hmm. Adhesions can cause problems anywhere, and they just happened to happen on some bad real estate in his gut. And so he had several adhesive bands that they're able to release. But by that point, there was already some pretty, pretty dusky segments along that biliopancreatic limb. So they had to do some resections. But even more concerning is that he probably from his terrible EF was already having some dusky changes in other portions of his abdomen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he was left open and with plans for reoperation, which ultimately happened. And as Lucas mentioned, his course was very, very troubled in no small part to the fact that he had both a bad pathology surgically and then sort of a poor baseline with a really bad EF that made his shock state really poorly tolerated.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So a couple of bad things all happening at once. Just before you said that, I was wondering, if he didn't have such a low flow state to start with, mm-hmm. is this something that still would have happened anyway in terms of the ischemia and infarction, or is it really that combination that put him into dire straits? I guess it's kind of tough to tell.
I think it's probably the combination.
Yeah.
So afferent loop with a complete obstruction still has a significant operative mortality, even people who don't have his comorbidities. But most of that is due to the fact that you can get perforation and spillage. In this case, there were a lot of other issues that led to his ischemia.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think one big lesson that I think is important to take away from this case is that this is an obstructed bowel that doesn't necessarily follow the rules of an obstructed bowel. Because the gastric contents and sort of bowel contents can still flow through this newly created tract, you won't necessarily have vomiting. So a lot of the, especially early symptoms, are going to be more pain, tachycardia. A lot of times it's going to be upper abdominal pain. And the passage of flatus and stool can still be happening with a lot more consistency than a typical bowel obstruction.
So that's very atypical for a bowel obstruction.
So
that makes
it a little
more difficult. So I guess in retrospect, or let's say my next shift, I've got the exact same patient coming in. What should be the tip-off to me, aside from the fact that we just did a podcast on this, what should be the tip-off that we need to worry about something like this? Here we've got a person that you're saying we don't necessarily rely on nausea, vomiting, or absence of flatus. Is it just the tachycardia? Throw me a bone. Give me something that's going to help me make the diagnosis.
I think this is a case where ultimately the history is pivotal.
Okay.
And getting a good surgical history of what type of operation have they had, and specifically with the Roux-en-Y, why that has this particular complication of an afferent loop syndrome. So the other procedures like the sleeve gastrectomy and the gastric band and other versions don't have this particular complication. And in this particular patient, it was very tough because they were really not able, both for their own reasons and intoxication and other issues, weren't really able to provide that history. The only thing that probably would have helped was to know that potential diagnosis early.
Sure.
And it's not even clear when he had the initial obstruction, because these afferent loops and other hernias can come with vomiting, with other things, be triggered in that sense.
Yeah.
And especially in the post-bariatric surgery patient, tachycardia should really raise a lot of concerns, particularly early complications, things like anastomotic leaks. Tachycardia can be the only symptom. And there's a sort of an adage in the bariatric surgery world that a heart rate greater than 120 is an anastomotic leak until you prove that it isn't. I think if I could go back and do anything differently in the case, I think I would probably not have started his imaging workup with an ultrasound. I think if we had known his surgical history earlier, the imaging modality of choice for bariatric surgery patients is going to be a CT scan. Mm-hmm. And this is an instance where my residents are going to fry me. I actually do want to give oral contrast.
I was just about to ask.
In this instance, this is one of the rare instances where oral contrast, I think, actually is really beneficial.
Sure.
It can help you diagnose things like anastomotic leaks, obstructions. And because the GI tract now has such an altered anatomy, it can help that radiologist really follow it and help that surgeon as well when they're looking at this, figure out where this bowel is going, what is it doing, and where the problem is.
Sure. And, of course, the drawback of oral contrast is that it adds extra delay as
it
well.
It does, yeah.
So you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, as they say. That's tough. So as our population gets literally bigger, mm-hmm. we're seeing more and more post-bariatric surgery patients, and we're seeing more complications as a necessary part of just seeing more of these patients. And we're slowly learning more and more about post-bariatric surgery complications. But I have to tell you, if I ever learned about afferent loop syndrome before, it's gone. Or it's in some neuron way, way back in some gray matter, which I've probably decayed away now. So That's really, really an interesting case.
Yeah. And the part of the problem that, you know, Lucas and I ran into when we were sort of doing some background research is that it's called at least three different things in the literature. So looking it up, we can't even decide what we're going to call it. Is it afferent loop syndrome? Is it obstruction of the biliopancreatic limb? Is it obstruction of the excluded limb? So there's just a lot of
gastric remnant distension.
Yeah. We can't even decide what we're going to call it.
Should we call it just Shiklaka-Manning syndrome?
That sounds great.
I'm all for that.
Got to get you named after something. So outside of the afferent loop syndrome, are there any other things that we should be on the lookout for?
Yes. In particular with Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, internal hernia, which is a type of hernia we may not be used to hearing about, is both a prevalent condition and something that can cause really serious complications. And so the way to think about it is, you know, we think of external hernia as going through the inguinal ring or going through an old incision site. In this case, the incision sites where the bowel can slip through are actually internal. Because you have to divide the bowel to do the reconnections, there are spots in that mesentery, that part where the bowel actually hangs out and gets its blood supply from the root of the mesentery. Those spots are natural weak points, and surgeons have gotten better with their techniques. They now close these points and use surgical techniques to limit the number of these points, but they can open up, and internally, a piece of bowel can slide through the mesentery of another bowel, and that can cause blockage. It can cause ultimately necrosis. It's one of the reasons that afferent loop syndrome can occur is the presence of an internal hernia. And in patients who have gastric bypass surgery who have obstructive type of symptoms, the most common cause of a small bowel obstruction in these patients is actually an internal hernia. It's not actually adhesive disease. And so the big difference between this is internal hernias, when they're suspected, are usually managed with an operation. They don't typically try conservative management because the risk of that happening again and causing a much more serious complication is so high that most surgeons will plan to take that patient back to the OR to try to close that defect and confirm the diagnosis.
Sure. So this is not just put an NG tube down, make them NPO, and put them on the medicine service.
Admit OBS. When you suspect this, this is when cross-sectional imaging, CT scan is going to be really important. Oral contrast, if they can tolerate it, to figure out where that hernia segment is. And if it's an internal hernia, they probably need an operation.
Sure. That's such an important point. So if you're suspicious for a bowel obstruction in somebody who's had prior gastric surgery, you really need to go all the way, CAT scan, and get surgery involved, and not just NPO, NG tube, and admit for OBS. Because that could be a deadly consequence.
Absolutely.
That in and of itself is a nice, really nice take-home pearl. All right, as long as we're talking about post-bariatric complications, are there any other key complications that you want to just remind our listeners about?
Another complication that's fairly specific to Roux-en-Y gastric bypass is the development of something called marginal ulcers. And we talked about that connection between the tiny stomach and now that loop of bowel that's been brought up. So that connection is prone to stricture, and it's relatively unprotected from stomach acid. And so these patients can get ulcers at that site that can cause bleeding. They can also get strictures and tightening of that area, which can lead to obstruction of their stomach, or it can also lead to afferent loop syndrome itself. And so as that area tightens and scars down from acid, in patients who have typical GERD-type symptoms, who've had a history of bariatric surgery, you need to think, if they otherwise are clinically ill, you need to think really early about whether they should be referred for therapy, because often these patients will need to have an endoscopy for surveillance to see if they're developing a stricture. Some of these patients will need dilations to actually keep those areas open, and will often need, if they're not on them already, high-dose PPI, sucralfate, a lot of the other therapies. But these patients usually need to follow closely with a gastroenterologist for some time after their surgery because these risks of complications are so high.
Sure. The marginal ulcers, is there a time course that we need to think about this? Like, is this something in the first couple weeks, or is this something that can develop years and years later?
It can develop years and years later.
Okay.
Usually these patients are on acid suppression for quite some time after their surgery. Often they will eventually go off it, partially because it reduces the amount of weight they tend to lose the longer they're on a PPI. But some studies show rates of up to 20% over 5-10 years out. And it's not clear exactly when they may be back to baseline risk, if ever, of having that complication.
That's a troubling point about a lot of the post-bariatric surgery complications that we encounter in the emergency department, is a lot of these are very delayed from their initial operative procedure. So a lot of times patients and the physicians treating them won't necessarily link this surgical procedure they had 3-5 years ago to the pathology they're demonstrating today. But a lot of these complications are increased when the patient has lost the weight.
Sure.
Things like internal hernias, the more weight you lose, the more likely you are to have them develop. So it's just an unfortunate reality.
Yeah, and the history gets lost because of the length of time from their procedure. They may not recall to tell you, and now you've put them on an NSAID or put them on steroids, or they've had a complaint of pain that doesn't trigger alarm bells because they may not volunteer that history of a bypass.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of other sort of complications that are specific in this patient population, way too many to talk about today. Things as not EM as nutritional deficiencies, but I've personally seen a post-bariatric surgery patient with Wernicke's encephalopathy. That can certainly happen. There's some early complications that we can see, particularly as times in the perioperative period for hospitalization get shorter and shorter. You'll see the anastomotic leaks. You'll see hemorrhage. And then there's a couple of things that are important to think about just because the way that we usually take care of them is limited. Things like biliary stone disease. Patients develop gallstones much more frequently after bariatric surgery, and now your use of ERCP is going to be basically impossible because there's no scope that can get to this location anymore. Mm-hmm. So a lot of things that wouldn't necessarily be operative in a non-bariatric surgery patient is suddenly operative.
Sure. All right. Well, that was a really, really interesting discussion. And I feel like I need to go right home and read a nice review article on this topic.
Well, bad news for you, Amal. It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist.
You guys got to write it. So, all right, I'm expecting you guys to write the article.
We might have to.
The all-encompassing article. Now, there's been a handful of articles over the years, and we've actually done at least one or two of those articles over the years, but they're unfortunately tough to get through because they're very visual, and the procedures seem to change somewhat, you know.
Oh, they've changed massively.
Yeah.
They change frequently. Centers have strong preferences for the kind of procedures, so it's hard to map what is going on in your area to one other area.
Yeah. Well, can you leave us with, say, just a couple of really, really key take-home points from this case before we sign off? Lucas?
Sure. So bariatric surgery patients need a really clear surgical history because if they have a Roux-en-Y especially, they're at much higher risk for serious complications like afferent loop or internal hernia.
All right, good point.
Yeah. And I would say two things. One, that a lot of these complications can occur way after their procedure, after the patient and you have totally forgotten that they've had that Roux-en-Y. So, keep it in the back of your mind, look for those surgical scars, ask about them. And then if your patient's tachycardic and they've had bariatric surgery, you better have a really good reason why they're tachycardic.
So tachycardia means you need to worry about them.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your time and sharing this really, really interesting and scary case. But I think there's some really fantastic take-home points from this as well. Well, I look forward to getting you guys both back for some more EMCast. And Lucas, looking forward to some good critical care cases in the coming couple years also.
Absolutely. Thanks, Amal.
Thanks.
All right. Well, next up on EMed Home's EMCast, we're going to spend some time talking about oncologic emergencies. And joining me, of course, is one of my colleagues, Dr. Sarah Dubbs. I say, of course, because this is one of her real areas of particular interest in her academic niche. Sarah's been on the EMCast before, but just to recap who she is and what she does, she's one of our full-time faculty. She is an assistant program director for our program and has done a faculty development fellowship and teaching fellowship through ACEP. And over the years, she's developed a real interest in oncologic emergencies. And actually, before we get into the paper, Sarah, how did you get interested in oncologic emergencies? That's not a real common type of niche to have.
Well, thanks, Amal, for having me again. There are a lot of reasons why I'm really interested in oncoemergencies. But the main reason first, and unfortunately, many members of my family have been affected by cancer, so it's really personal for me. And then the second reason is that the incidence of cancer just keeps expanding and getting bigger. So we're seeing more and more cancer patients in our emergency departments. Sometimes it's through the initial diagnosis in a perfectly stable patient. Sometimes it's a crashing patient with something intervenable. Sometimes it's the patient fighting side effects or toxicities from the cancer treatment. And other times it's about palliation and dignified end-of-life care.
Sure, sure. There's a lot of different things that we can get into. But let's get into this paper, first of all. This is a nice review article that was published in March 2019 in the Western Journal of Emergency Medicine. And the authors were Sarah Klemenchik, I hope I'm getting that right, Klemenchik, and Jack Perkins. Jack is actually one of our EMIM graduates from a number of years ago. And in this paper, they went through quite an assortment of oncologic emergencies and just gave brief reviews about all of them. So I'm just going to kind of throw them out to you, and you can kind of tell us what you think we as regular emergency physicians that don't have a niche in oncologic emergencies, what do you think we need to know? Sound good?
Sounds great.
All right. So let's start with the biggie, neutropenic fever.
Okay. Neutropenic fever. It's the classic oncologic emergency. So up to 80% of patients getting chemotherapy for hematologic emergencies will develop neutropenic fever at least once during their course of treatment. So you're going to see it a lot. It occurs a little less often in patients with solid tumors, affecting anywhere from about 10 to 50%. Now, just a reminder on the definition of neutropenic fever. The fever counts if the patient has, one, a single temperature of greater than or equal to 38.3 degrees Celsius, or 101 for those that work in Fahrenheit, or a temperature of greater than or equal to 38.0 degrees Celsius, or 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit, sustained over 60 minutes. Okay. So, like, you take a temperature, take it again an hour later, and sure, it's still 100.4.
That all seems very arbitrary. I don't know. Yeah. Somebody sat down and came up with these definitions, I guess.
Definitely.
But, all right.
In regards to the neutropenia, we consider the absolute neutrophil counts between 1,000 to 1,500 as mild neutropenia, 500 to 1,000 moderate, and under 500 severe. It's not mentioned in the article, but I'll add that you also need to take the timing of the patient's chemotherapy into account. If they haven't quite hit that neutropenic range yet, but are approaching the nadir window of that 7 to 10 days after chemotherapy, you should really treat them as if they just have neutropenic fever.
Sure. Okay, so I guess what I've learned is that, well, when I was in residency, anything under 1,000 was considered neutropenic. Then they kind of changed things. And they said if it's under 500, definitely neutropenia. If it's over 1,000, it's not neutropenic. And then in that 500 to 1,000 range, it was kind of equivocal. So I guess what you're suggesting is that if somebody's in that 500 to 1,000 range and it looks like they're heading down because they're approaching that 7 to 10 day nadir, then just go ahead and treat them like neutropenia. But if you think maybe they're heading north, then maybe less concerned about that? Or would you still worry in that 500 to 1,000 range?
I would still be a bit worried in that 500 to 1,000 range. And when it comes time to talk about disposition and discussions, we can go over that
okay.
as well.
Sounds good. All right.
So we typically think of neutropenic fever as being alarming for severe bacterial infection. Sometimes the source pops up right away on our workup. Many times it doesn't. Studies show only a clinically documented infection in 20 to 25% of patients. Neutropenic fever can also be caused by the malignancy itself, non-infectious drug reactions to the chemo, or a whole host of other things. The thing is, we don't yet know how to really differentiate the patients who have occult infection versus those who have the neutropenic fever from something else.
Sure, sure.
A systemic workup is key to the diagnostic evaluation of these patients. When a bacterial source is identified, it's likely to be an endogenous flora from the gut, the skin, or the respiratory tract. As always, a really good history and an exam with special attention to the mouth, the sinuses, and the skin, along with any indwelling lines or ports, is super important.
Okay. And I assume blood cultures is part of your workup there?
Exactly. So blood culture should definitely be obtained in all neutropenic patients, with one from any indwelling lines if the patient has one too. Urine analysis and urine cultures are also pretty standard in the initial workup, as well as a chest film. But a word of caution, neutropenic patients can't mount a robust inflammatory response. So the sensitivity of a chest x-ray is actually really pretty low. So my recommendation, and I think is fairly common practice, is either to go straight to a non-contrasted CT or order that CT if the chest x-ray comes back normal.
Sure. And are you doing that for everybody with neutropenic fever and no clear-cut source, or is it only in people that have a cough or some pulmonary symptoms? What's your practice?
If a patient has cough or pulmonary symptoms, mm-hmm. if they don't look well overall, sometimes you may be able to get away with avoiding that x-ray if they have a clear other source.
Okay.
But if they don't have an obvious source, then I typically would go sure. ahead and image.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
And during flu season, all patients should definitely get influenza testing. And the rest of the workup will be based on clinical management. So, for example, if your patient comes in with diarrhea, check for C. diff. If they have a lot of belly pain, nausea, vomiting, or other GI symptoms, go ahead and get that CT and have a low threshold of imaging the abdomen.
Okay. All right. So that's a pretty standard workup there. What about the treatment?
So if you find a reliable source, treatment should be directed at that source. If one is not found, empiric treatment for stable patients with neutropenic fever should cover gram negatives. Check at your local institution what the preferences may be, but common regimens tend to include cefepime or meropenem or piptazo or ceftazidime.
Sure.
So in terms of additional coverage, sometimes that is needed for certain patients. Patients that have an indwelling line or look like they have a skin or soft tissue infection as a source, or who are already on antibiotic prophylaxis at home and who are hypotensive or ill-appearing should get additional coverage with gram-positive, such as vancomycin.
Okay. All right.
And then finally, when it comes to disposition, while it's true that the vast majority of these patients require admission to the hospital, it's not quite a slam dunk. Hospital admissions come with their own risk, and crowding is definitely an issue. Believe it or not, there are select patients that could be discharged home after a workup and a dose of parenteral antibiotics with really good close follow-up.
Sure.
So larger cancer centers have protocols and recommendations from various oncology organizations do exist, but they're mainly based on two pretty well-studied clinical decision tools. The more established one is the MASC score, and MASC stands for Multinational Association for Supportive Care in Cancer.
So and that's then, the MASCC score.
Yes.
I actually haven't heard of that before.
Ah, very nice. Right. Well, it's definitely out there. And
now I have.
And now you have. And the other is the CISNE score, which is the Clinical Index of Stable Febrile Neutropenia.
Right.
And you can reference the article for these details, but you can also, you know, Google them or find them on
sure.
other sources.
So the CISNE index, another one that I have not heard of before. So cool. All right.
There you go. And just again, a word of caution, you should still make your dispositions in coordination with your oncologist. Mm-hmm. Don't make them in a vacuum, even if you're using these scores, because you have to have that robust and coordinated plan for
sure.
follow-up.
Sure. All right. Well, neutropenic fever is definitely the most, I think it's the most common, I shouldn't say definitely, I think it's the most common cancer-related issue that we see in the emergency department or the emergent issue. They, in the paper, go through a handful of others that we are always thinking about and worry about and certainly show up on the boards quite a bit. And one of the classics is tumor lysis syndrome. So what should we know about tumor lysis syndrome?
Yeah, tumor lysis syndrome is super scary. The mortality of tumor lysis syndrome is estimated to be at 29 to 79%. That's like ginormous,
That's
right?
a big range, but it's still pretty high.
It's a big range, but yeah. I think in general, oncologists are pretty good at prophylaxing and monitoring for it, but it's certainly something that needs to be on our radar. So tumor lysis syndrome most commonly occurs after cytotoxic chemotherapy treatment, when all the cells are basically like exploding and mm-hmm. leaking their contents into the bloodstream. So additionally, though, it can occur spontaneously in patients with hematologic malignancies, especially acute leukemias. So the scenario where a patient comes into the ED with no known cancer diagnosis presenting in tumor lysis is actually a really real possibility.
Okay. What are the signs and symptoms we need to worry about?
Patients will come in with anything from very vague fatigue, nausea and vomiting and dehydration, all the way to seizures and cardiac dysrhythmias. The trouble from tumor lysis syndrome is all about metabolic derangements and damage from the hyperkalemia, hyperphosphatemia, and hyperuricemia. And then In terms of workup, you should absolutely obtain levels on these big three, as well as calcium levels, because you'll see a drop due to precipitation with phosphate for this.
Okay. And in order to make the diagnosis, is it kind of gestalt looking at the labs, or what specifically helps you make the diagnosis then?
Yeah, so you'll also get a urine analysis, creatinine, LDH, and certainly an EKG as part of the workup. And there is criteria that defines tumor lysis syndrome, and this is called the Kiro-Bishop criteria. Have you heard of that one?
I have not.
All right. I'm teaching Kiro, you something.
Yes, the Kiro-Bishop criteria, all right.
Yes, and so again, this can be referenced in the article or otherwise online, but that defines specific lab numbers as well as clinical features that will provide the diagnosis officially of tumor lysis syndrome. So once you've diagnosed it, treatment starts with aggressive IV fluids and correction of the electrolyte abnormalities. A huge word of caution, though, be really careful with administering calcium. It can actually worsen tumor lysis syndrome by causing more precipitation with phosphate and jacking up the kidneys even worse. So only use it if your patient has severe symptomatic hypocalcemia, and in the case of hyperkalemia, only if the patient has had or has impending cardiac dysrhythmia. Otherwise, you can reduce the potassium with other means. And for the uric acid, many patients may already be on allopurinol as prophylaxis, but it actually doesn't work well once the uric acid is already present in the blood. So in this case, a medication called resveratrol has to be used. It's a recombinant urate oxidase that metabolizes the uric acid into a form that can be renally excreted.
Okay, all right. Well, that's an interesting point about the calcium. I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah, you actually have to be really careful.
Wow,
yeah.
Okay. All right. And then how about the disposition of these patients? Are any of them going home, or are they all coming in?
They're pretty much all coming in, and most of these patients need to go to the ICU where they can be closely monitored and labs can be checked frequently.
Okay. Okay, next in the paper, they talk about hypercalcemia, specifically hypercalcemia of malignancy.
Yes, so hypercalcemia is seen in about 10 to 30% of patients with cancer, most commonly patients with breast or lung cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and multiple myeloma. I think the most important point from the article is that if we as emergency physicians incidentally pick up hypercalcemia where there's an unclear etiology, we should take it as a red flag of potential malignancy. So this is a time where you can really make a difference in someone's outcome by paying attention to this detail when it comes up. But focusing on the symptoms, with hypercalcemia, it's also very vague and nonspecific. Patients will have anorexia or decreased appetite, nausea, vomiting, constipation, and malaise or altered mental status.
That's the bones, stones, groans.
Psychiatric overtones, all right. Yes, all that.
All right, well, that's half our patients. We should be screening more calcium levels.
That's true.
So, all right.
So the hypercalcemia causes an osmotic diuresis too. So patients will come in with a lot of dehydration and significant volume depletion. So if you see a cancer patient with dehydration, think about hypercalcemia.
Sure. And I guess vice versa, can hypercalcemia produce the dehydration?
Yeah, it probably is so, kind of a circle, circular.
A vicious cycle.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I remember way back in residency, maybe one of the only things I remember about hypercalcemia for residency was somebody in a lecture saying that pretty much anyone who's hypercalcemic is dehydrated. And so just give them all tons of fluids.
Yes,
which may have been, I don't know if that was an overstatement, but I think it stuck with me.
No, it's true. Oh, and right. That's the mainstay of the treatment.
Okay.
Kind of going back and talking about EKGs. So obviously with hypercalcemia, you can pick that up on the EKG with prolonged PR, widened QRS, shortened QT, or even ventricular dysrhythmias.
Sure. All right.
And like you said, lots and lots of fluids is the mainstay of treatment. So it actually, you can finesse it a little bit depending on the levels. So for patients who have a level of less than 12 milligrams per deciliter, they actually don't need to be that aggressively managed and can follow up as an outpatient. For moderate levels, as defined by 12 to 14 milligrams per deciliter, they should be treated just based on symptoms and clinical judgment. So if they're kind of symptomatic, then go ahead and treat them, give them fluids. Mm-hmm. If they're not really all that symptomatic, just have them follow up. And then anyone with a level greater than 14 is generally symptomatic and should receive intervention to lower the calcium.
Got it.
And so when we initiate treatment, again, we start with aggressive IV fluids. You want to bolus 1 or 2 liters and then infuse at a rate to kind of get a goal urine output of 100 to 150 mLs per hour.
Okay.
Other medications you can use are loop diuretics, bisphosphonates, steroids, calcitonin, and then even dialysis, but this is at a higher level and should be discussed in conjunction with your specialists.
Okay. All right, good. The last topic in the paper they talk about is hyperviscosity syndrome, another bread and butter boards type of thing. And I can't say that I've seen it too often, but this can produce some really, really concerning cardiovascular type of presentations also. I have seen maybe 1 or 2 in 20 years of patients presenting with that, but you hear about those, and those oftentimes show up in those M&M cases also.
Yeah. And the cases of hyperviscosity syndrome that I've seen are actually tend to be more of polycythemia related ones,
okay.
But definitely something that can happen in cancer patients as well. So hyperviscosity syndrome is another high mortality onc emergency. It's caused by an excess of serum proteins, for example, in multiple myeloma, and then Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia.
Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia.
Yes, you got it. Or an excess of cellular components like white blood cells in acute leukemia.
Sure.
So this is the one instance where white blood cell count really matters.
Yeah, and neutropenic fever.
A couple others, yes.
All right, so in cancer patients, the white blood cell count might have some utility there. All right, fair enough.
This is true. So labs-wise, you'll obviously see elevated white blood cell counts or protein and albumin levels based on the etiology. And the mainstay of therapy is initially decreasing the viscosity with IV fluids, and then more specific treatments depending on that etiology. If it's an acute leuke, patients may require urgent chemo. If it's polycythemia, they need phlebotomy. And then other options are plasmapheresis or leukapheresis. All of these patients require admission, usually to the ICU, and they're really sick.
All right. Now, are there any other big ticket items we need to know about besides these few that we've discussed?
Yeah. So outside of this article, other like high mortality, need to diagnose and intervene in the ED, big ticket items include tamponade from pericardial fusions, cardiotoxicities that cause vasospasm, coronary syndrome, and heart failure, graft versus host disease, cord compression from Mets, and then now the new cancer therapies that are immune-based and have their own set of adverse reactions and toxicities. And then even further than that, now that the survival rates are climbing, long-term effects of treatments are on the rise. So there's a lot more to come on that.
Sure. And we'll be looking forward to hearing from you about those things for sure. So the last thing I'll ask you, can you tell us what you consider to be the biggest pitfalls that you've seen in ED management of oncologic patients?
Yes, Amal. I'll put two things out there. So the first pitfall is not taking a good onc history. So that's one of my pet peeves. What was the type and timing of treatments? Did the patient get chemo infusion, oral chemo, immunotherapy, radiation, surgery? Like, there's so many different kinds of treatments out there nowadays, and it's really important to know what exactly they got and when they got it. Also, what prophylactic meds are they on? So are they on antibiotics? Are they on allopurinol? Mm-hmm. Are they on other stuff? And then, you know, again, knowing this gives us a better overall understanding of the patient's course, and it'll go a long way to inform the appropriate workup and disposition of that patient. The second pitfall is missing the big picture. So, like, what are the patient's goals of care? We really can play a big role in managing these patients through the ups and downs of their treatment. So taking a second to really ask them, like, what can we do to help you today is really important.
Sure.
And that They don't like to be in the ED in the first place, and God forbid they've been waiting in the waiting room amongst our usual crowd for a long time waiting to see us when it's the last place they want to be. And so, you know, talking with them and about how we can make them feel better is really important.
Sure. Well, those are some really excellent pearls to finish up with. So, Sarah, thanks again for taking us through this article, and it sounds like there's a lot more for us to discuss on the topic of hem-onc emergencies, so we'll have to get you back to enlighten us a little bit about some of those other conditions as well.
Looking forward to it.
All right, thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Well, it is time for the summary for the March issue of EMCast. We started things off with the discussion of acute compartment syndrome with Michael Bond. And again, this is a surgical emergency caused by excessive pressure in the fascia compartment, which results in decreased perfusion within the compartment and leads to muscle and nerve damage and eventually can lead to amputation. It's a true musculoskeletal and orthopedic disaster. Now, everyone's always taught to look for the six classic P's, including pulselessness, but bear in mind, pulselessness is a late finding. Remember what the classic P's are. Michael mentioned five. I always think about six. Pain, pallor, paresis, poikilothermia, paresthesias, and pulselessness. I think that's six. But pulselessness is very late. Probably the most sensitive finding to be on the lookout for is pain. Well, pain is so nonspecific, but pain, severe burning and deep pain that's worse with passive stretch of the compartment is really, really important to assess. And serial exams can be very important. So when you have even a trace of concern of compartment syndrome, do some serial exams and document serial exams. Remember that lab testing and imaging are pretty much useless. What is the diagnostic gold standard is measuring compartment pressures, and in fact, the delta pressure is key. What is the delta pressure? Well, what you do is you take the diastolic blood pressure and then subtract the compartment pressure, and if that delta is less than 30, you ought to be concerned. If it's less than 20, that's pretty much an indication for a fasciotomy. But you've got to do those compartment pressures. And if you're not going to do it yourself, get your consultant to come down. And there's a couple of devices that can be used. Most hospitals, if not all hospitals, have consultants like orthopedic physicians that have access to those devices. If you don't have access to the device, just go on YouTube or check out Robertson Hedges, and it'll tell you how to kind of jerry-rig your own device. Next, we talked about post-bariatric surgery complications with a very interesting case of afferent loop syndrome. Again, I don't think I knew anything about this, or if I did, I totally forgot about it. What exactly is this? Well, the blind pouch that occurs with the Roux-en-Y surgery can be thought of as like a big appendix or a giant loop of bowel that's not connected to anything, but it accumulates a lot of drainage of bile content and pancreatic enzymes, which mixes up at the Y junction. And then if that Y junction becomes very tight, it can't drain, it continues to fill with fluid, becomes overdistended, and actually can cause a rupture, just like a ruptured appendix. And if the afferent loop is blocked off, it can produce abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, bacterial overgrowth, ultimately necrosis, rupture, and can even cause death. It's got a relatively high mortality. Other post-bariatric surgery complications to be on the lookout for include the anastomotic leak. And a great pearl that was brought up is that if you ever encounter tachycardia in the post-bariatric surgery patient, maybe the first few weeks after the bariatric surgery, unexplained tachycardia, that is an anastomotic leak until proven otherwise. So get those surgeons involved in care of those patients relatively early. If you're going to image patients for any of the complications, CT, especially with oral contrast, is very useful because the anatomy is all screwed up, and I think your radiologist will really thank you for adding the oral contrast before that CAT scan. Other common post-Roux-en-Y bariatric surgery complications include internal hernia and marginal ulcers. I'm not going to go through the details there. Just take a listen again to the podcast, but there's a lot of really bad players in terms of the complications that you can get post-bariatric surgery. So have a low threshold to get that CT with oral contrast also and getting surgery involved as well. Finally, we finish things up by reviewing a handful of oncologic emergencies. Of course, there's neutropenic fever, which I think most people are pretty savvy with because it's relatively common. Remember that because these patients are immunosuppressed, that limits the inflammatory response that you normally expect to see. So you may not see an infiltrate on chest x-ray, because what is an infiltrate? It's an accumulation of inflammatory cells. If somebody can't mount the inflammatory response, they're not always going to have the infiltrate on plain film. CAT scan oftentimes will pick it up better than the plain film. You may not always see a lot of white cells in the urine or even white cells in the CSF. So empiric coverage, especially when a patient looks sick, is really, really important. And with your empiric antibiotic coverage, always remember to cover gram-negatives. Those are the bad players here. So typical regimens might include IV cefepime or meropenem or piperacillin, tazobactam or ceftazidime, make sure to cover those gram negatives. And if the patient has any indwelling lines or any evidence of a skin or soft tissue source, then add the vancomycin also. Good gram-positive coverage. And, of course, in this day and age of MRSA, we're just going right to the vancomycin. Tumor lysis syndrome was briefly discussed. This occurs after a cytotoxic chemotherapy when the cells explode and leak contents into the bloodstream. You can also have, this can also occur with hematologic malignancies, especially acute leukemia. Signs and symptoms include fatigue, nausea, vomiting, dehydration, seizures, cardiac dysrhythmias. And in terms of the lab workup, you look for hyper-K, hyperphosphatemia, hyperuricemia, and hypocalcemia. The calcium goes low because calcium precipitates with the phosphate. In terms of treatment there, you want to generally reserve calcium for patients that have severe hypocalcemia or hyperkalemia. The typical medication that is used, however, is rasburicase, which is a recombinant version of urate oxidase, and enough said about that. Just remember rasburicase. Hypercalcemia is relatively common in malignancy. In fact, 10 to 30% of patients with cancer will end up getting it, most commonly breast, lung, multiple myeloma, and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma types of cancer are at highest risk. But all comers, up to a third of patients with cancer will eventually get hypercalcemia, so you've got to be on the lookout for this. And remember the mnemonic, bones, stones, abdominal groans, psychiatric overtones, essentially anorexia, nausea, vomiting, constipation, malaise, altered mental status. Patients can be very, very achy and have unexplained abdominal pain. What are you looking for in the labs? Well, of course, hypercalcemia. And on EKG, what does hypercalcemia do to the EKG? We've got to talk about EKGs here, right? Well, prolonged PR, wide QRS, ventricular arrhythmias, but the most classic thing to look for is a short QT. Hypercalcemia will shorten that QT. How do you treat these patients? Fluids. And then after fluids, you give fluids. And then after fluids, give more fluids. These patients need good hydration. So fluids, fluids, fluids is essentially your treatment of choice right up front. Later on, you can think about loop diuretics and bisphosphonates, but primary ED management for hypercalcemia is going to be fluids. And then one other cancer condition that was discussed was hyperviscosity syndrome. This results from excess of serum proteins with multiple myeloma and a few other conditions. Labs show markedly elevated white count, protein, and albumin. And the patients oftentimes have problems related to hyperviscosity. So you want to decrease viscosity with, once again, crystalloid fluids. There are a couple of other things that Sarah talked about. Tamponade for malignant pericardial fusions and cardiotoxicities and a few other things we're not going to go into detail here. But those are the main things that were discussed during this particular article. All right, folks, well, I think that wraps it up for the summary for this month in March. I hope everybody's having a really great spring, and I look forward to talking to all of you next month. Bye for now.
Hey, thanks for listening to MCAST. And for listening to the end, here's a discount code for you. Use discount code PODCAST for 10% off each year of an annual subscription to emedhome.com.